This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Tonight we come back to what we talked about 2 weeks ago, that's the whole principle of Hakoras HaTov, and specifically the enrichment that Hakoras HaTov can bring in a human being and in life in general, and the power and strength of it. 2 weeks ago we defined Hakoras HaTov, and we defined it as an inability to tolerate dependence. It's the Torah's equivalent to a teenage rebellion. When the teenager wants to be independent, he goes out of the house, he goes on his own. When the Jew wants to be independent, he pays his debts. That's the way a Jew gets independent. The teenager is just immature. He doesn't realize that it doesn't help running away. If you've got creditors, what's the good? And he doesn't realize that he happens to have an old man and an old lady, as they call them, who are creditors, whom he hasn't paid off yet. And you can't just run away from your creditors and say, now I'm independent because I'm out of his house. It just doesn't make any difference. Your dependence on your parents is not because you're living in their house. Your dependence on them is because you owe them and you haven't paid. That's why it is. And we talked about Hakoras HaTov as that middle in a human being which makes him want to pay off his debts. And we discussed that there are many debts that can never be paid off. A parental debt can't be paid off. So the man who has Hakoras HaTov, despite the fact that it can't be paid off, devotes his lifetime to paying off as much of it as he can, because he likes to feel that at least he's doing everything he can to pay off. Whereas the man who lacks the Hakoras HaTov, he says, well, you know, I can't pay in any case, thanks Ma and Pa, and he gives a little speech at the mitzvah, and he gives another speech at his wedding, and to the poor rabbis that have to go to the mitzvahs and weddings will tell you that one speech is like the next, and there's not very much individuality, the jokes are a little bit in better taste or in worse taste, but it's all the same, thanks Ma and Pa for being so wonderful, and all the rest of it. And then they've been yotze lechiyuv to their parents. Doesn't work like that at all. We talked about old age and old age tones and things like that too. Last week we discussed we started off with the din that as extreme as are the demands of the Shulchan Aruch, the demands of Jewish law on a child towards his parents, and we define those demands in terms of Hakoras HaTov, we define the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em as a halachic expression of the midah of Hakoras HaTov, as extreme as those demands are, and there's no other word to describe them but as extreme, still more extreme are the demands of the Talmud on his Rav. And we discussed, we defined what the role of the Rav is in that particular relationship. And we described how really an individual learns Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's God's Torah. It's not the Rav's Torah. That in fact is the difference between learning Torah and learning anything else. A Rav's greatest thrill is when he's been able to convey to his Talmud that which he has learnt, not which that he has invented. Not his ideas. A rabbi gets a thrill out of conveying his ideas, is not conveying Torah, he's conveying philosophy. When it's Torah, his thrill comes out of the fact that he's been able to convey the Torah as he received it. So really the Talmud is getting Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's not getting Torah from the God, from the Rav. Except, the Rav gives him the facility to be Mekabel Torah. We discussed what Kabbalah HaTorah was, and I brought you the Medrash in the Yalkut Shimoni, that with Aaron, how when Aaron used to bend his ear and soften his ear to Moshe Rabbeinu, although Aaron was as great as Moshe Rabbeinu in many ways and in some ways greater, Aaron nevertheless used to sit there and listen to every word carefully that Moshe Rabbeinu said, although he'd already heard it even in many cases. Because of that, Ma'ale Akos of the Torah regarded it as if Aaron himself had heard from God. So the concept of being Mekabel, when does the Talmud receive the Torah from God himself? When does the Talmud receive Torah, so to say, from directly from God? Only provided he's experienced Kabbalah HaTorah, receiving. And what is receiving? Receiving is the humbling of oneself and the nullifying of oneself to Torah. And that can only be done in a Rav Talmud relationship. And that's the way we explain the halachas of the Rav and the Talmud. And I was asked various questions afterwards. I didn't go into it fully in the shir. Obviously one has to be careful to distinguish on the one hand between that and any form of cultism, chas v'sholem, where what you're learning is Torah, you're not learning the Rav's philosophy, and what you're being mekabel is Torah, you're being mekabel Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam, not from any intermediary, and one has to bear that in mind all the time. And when you ask a Rav a shayla, you're not asking him for his opinion, you're asking him for what the halacha is, whether it's a shayla in Shulchan Aruch, or whether it's a shayla in attitude, or whether it's a shayla in midas, whether there is a seif and a paragraph that he can quote to you because it's covered by Shulchan Aruch, or whether it isn't because it's a matter of musar and it's a matter of attitude. Be that as it may, when you ask a Rav a shayla, you're asking what the halacha is, you're asking what the Torah says. And that's the difference between cultism and between a Rav Talmud relationship. The Talmud simply uses the Rav as the window or the door into the Torah, but his aim is to understand it in the Torah himself. That's what he's trying to do, and that's why I'm always so insistent that the man you ask your shailas is the man with whom you study, because the idea of the asking the shailas is not like a, you know, they have, I'm sorry to be quoting the East so often nowadays, but it's just the last interesting trip that I had, so that's where all my stimulation comes from at the moment. They have these Buddhists, all sorts of interesting things. One of them is a slot machine outside the, they make fortunes outside all their temples, and the hundreds of temples spotted all over the place, and you come and you stick a penny in the slot machine and it gives you out an answer about all your problems and brochas and all sorts of things, and if it is like that, and intelligent people, it's unbelievable. You see professors and businessmen come and they put their money in the slot machine, out comes a little settle, and they look at the settle, and if the settle's good luck they put it in their pocket, and if it's bad luck then they go and hang it on a special tree there, special tree where you hang all this tzetlach, and then they come the next day to check if the wind has blown it away, then they know that it's been cancelled out, the bad bracha has been cancelled out. And what happens of course is the priests come in the night time and they take 90% of them away, you know, so you've got to leave a few there for credibility, and a few people go away broken hearted that their brachas haven't been taken away, their clawless haven't been blown away, and the rest feel very relieved and so on. Be that as it may, asking a shayla is not like a slot machine where you just put something in and you get an answer, this is what you must do and this is what the answer is. Asking a shayla is really a temporary necessity, because in that particular area you're not sure yet, you haven't gained the knowledge yet to be able to decide that thing yourself. So until such time as you have gained enough knowledge, you need to ask in that particular area. You haven't learnt that yet, or you don't have access to those forum yet, or you can't, your shikul dat, your method of decision making is not sufficiently sophisticated yet in Torah to be able to figure it out, so you ask. But it's part of the learning process. You're asking for a vision into the Torah in a particular area where you haven't yet learned. But the place to ask is, where are you learning? And that's where one avoids cultism, and it becomes meaningless, and it becomes cultist, and it becomes formalistic if it's not done that way. You just go and you ask some stranger a whole lot of shailas, and he gives you a whole lot of answers. He doesn't know your name, you don't know his name, but he's answered your questions. That's not what it's meant to be. That's not the way it really is. On the one hand, one has to avoid that, the fear of cultism. One has to understand what a Rav tells you. You don't just do it without understanding. There's such a thing as Naaseh V'Nishma. Naaseh means, look, before I even ask you the Shaila, I want you to know, dear Rabbi, that what you tell me I'll do. Otherwise I wouldn't be here. However, I'll tell you also before I ask you the Shaila that when you've given me the answer, I'm going to ask you why. I'm going to ask you to explain it to me. And there is no greater pleasure than to explain the reasoning of an answer to somebody who's committed to it. There's nothing more wasteful than trying to explain the reason of an answer to somebody who's busy making up his mind whether to accept it or not. And then you're just arguing, then you're debating, you're not learning. But when a person has decided that this is what he's doing, that he wants a psak halacha and he's going to follow that psak halacha, but he wants to understand it, that's learning. And then you take out the sforim and you go through it with him so that he should understand it properly. That's the mature way to approach the asking of a shayla and the answering of a shayla. And sometimes Rav will say, I don't know the answer. Or he'll say, the answer is, for this we need a posek. This is not a question which is frequently asked. This is something very unique. It's a new type of question. And he will phrase the question to a posek. Or he will go with the shoyl, with the person who's asking. And together they'll put it to a posek. Or they'll write together. But then there's involvement. Then it's a learning process. It's taken out of the gather of mere formulas of, I need to know the answer, so I put the money in the slot machine. And it's moved into the area of learning and of studying, which is really what Torah is all about. It's all a learning process, whether it's men, women or children. We are people who learn. That's what we are. and it's learning and it's talking and it's discussing at our tables and in wherever it is, we're walking around the street, you're sitting at home, you're lying down, you're getting up. At all times it's v'dibartobam, we're people who are busy in Torah. It's always a learning process. On the other hand, one has to realize that while avoiding the cultist tendency, one also has to avoid the other tendency, which is the tendency of complete hefkeiros, the tendency of complete chaos and neglect in this area of understanding the questions of rabbinic authority and the questions of kovod haRav and kovod haTorah. And it's working this balance which is so critical and which one has to be so careful about. And tonight what I want to do is look again at Hakoras HaTov and then come back and answer the following question. If all that the Rav does is enable the Talmud to get Torah from God, what does he really need all that Hakoras HaTov for? Still more than a parent. When it comes to a parent, a child has to say, if it weren't for those parents, I wouldn't be here. And there's no way you can rationalize that away. That's just a fact of life. If it weren't for those parents, you wouldn't be here. Finished. But it's not necessarily the same with the Rav. It might be in some extreme situations that a man will say, if it wasn't for that Rav, I wouldn't be frum, or I wouldn't be Jewish, or I wouldn't be knowledgeable. But in most cases, if it wasn't for that one, I would have learned by another one. What difference does it make? So what is it here that the Shulchan Aruch starts off in his first sif is that as extreme as are the demands in the parental case, so much more still are the extremes in the Rav-Talmud relationship. There's something still that we haven't answered, which we'll do tonight. We'll start off with a very amazing Rashi, the end of the Torah in Ha'azina chapter Lamed Beis, verse Memchet. The end of Ha'azina, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe, and God said to Moshe, Be'etzem hayom hazeh lemor, in the middle of this day, on this very day, saying, Alei el har ha'avorim hazeh, go up to this mountain, Har Nevoi, and there you're going to die. This is the death of Moshe. Says Rashi, Bishloisho mekoimos ne'amar be'etzem hayoim hazeh. The word be'etzem hayoim hazeh is used three times. Etzem hayoim hazeh, there we learn how to be in the middle of the day, at midday. Ne'amar be'noach, one place it says is with Noach. Be'etzem hayoim hazeh bo'noach. At midday Noach came into the ark. B'maris oreh shel yom, when it was the clearest daylight of the day, everything was perfectly clear. Why? Lefi shehoyu b'nei doiroi oimrim bekach bekach im anu margishim boi ein anu menichim oisel likones b'teva. The people of his generation, of Noah's generation, used to say, if we notice him going into the ark, we'll stop him, we won't let him in. V'lo'oidu not only that, elana noitlim kishenim b'kardoim u'mevakim es ha'teva. We're going to take axes and choppers and we're going to break this ark up. We're not going to have it. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, God, Noach is going to go into the ark, not in the night time when nobody's looking, but at midday when everybody's looking. Anybody who thinks that he can stop it, let him come and try. In midday, in broad daylight, Noach is going to go into that ark. And again in Egypt, God said in the middle of the day, he's going to take the people out of Egypt. Because the Egyptians used to say, if we notice that they're about to go, we won't let them go. We're going to take swords and ammunition, and we're going to kill them if they try and escape. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, God, Hareinim Mitzian b'chatzi hayoim. I'm going to take them out in the middle of the day. V'chol mi sheyesh bo kach limchos yovei v'yimche. And anybody who wants to wipe them out, let them come and, anybody who wants to prevent it, let them come and prevent it. Af kan b'misosoi shel Moshe. Here also with the death of Moshe, ne'amar be'etzem hayoim hazeh. The same phrase is used, be'etzem hayoim hazeh. In the middle of the day, God is going to take Moshe away. Because Israel used to say as follows, if we notice that the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to take Moshe away from us, we won't allow it. The man who took us out of Egypt, the Kol Alonei Hayom, and he split the sea for us, V'hoirid lonu es hamon, and he brought down the manna for us. V'higiz lonu es haslov, and he brought the quail for us. V'heile lonu es habeir, and he brought us the water from the well. V'nosan lonu es hatera, and he gave us the Torah. Ein anu menichim oisoi, we won't leave him alone. God is not going to take this man away from us. I'm going to do it in the middle of the day. Moshe is going to die, and anybody who wants to stop it, let him come and try. This Rashi is amazing. The Havamina is amazing, that the people thought that they could stop Moshe from dying. And God's answer is amazing. He takes it seriously, and he gives exactly the same answer as he gives by Noach and by the Yetzias Mitzrayim. I'm going to do it in broad daylight, and it's only because I've been gazer that you won't be succeed in stopping his death. But it's implied that if it weren't that same kind of miraculous gezerah as with the flood and with the Yetzias Mitzrayim, you would succeed in stopping him dying. Is that possible? That a human being can prevent the death of another human being when God has decided the time has come? The answer is yes. It is possible. We have no idea of human power. We have no idea of the extent to which God has endowed the human being with physical power, with intellectual power, and with spiritual power, the most underutilized of all our powers. We read these stories of these strange mystical things in the East and all over the place, and we don't believe them. Of course they're true. A human being has tremendous mystical and spiritual power, which is completely unutilized because we don't know how to utilize it, and we're just not operating on that level enough. We're not using our physical power, and we're not using our intellectual power. But our powers go so far that there are times when we can challenge God, and in certain areas we can actually be victorious over Him. There are certain situations where God actually submits Himself to us. We had one example last night. The people, humanity decides when Yom Tov falls, and God follows our decision. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when God sits in judgment, who decides when God will sit in judgment? We do. We say today is going to be Rosh Hashanah. Next week is going to be Yom Kippur. And on that day, God sets some judgment. He binds Himself by our decisions. He binds Himself by our halachic decisions. Once He's given us the Torah, He's given it to us with the rules of how to use it, with the terms of interpretation, and God Himself binds Himself to our decisions. And even in a physical sense, exactly the same way as it was physically possible to hold Noach back and not let him in the ark. Imagine if it wasn't for this miracle of God. Simply, the whole of humanity was against the ark. So you just need a few hundred people to come, not even a few hundred people, five people, to come and to hold Noah back, that's all. And Yetzias Mitzrayim, you had a powerful army, one of the most powerful armies in the world at the time, Egypt. And you had 600,000 Jews with no arms, whatever. Is it terribly difficult to stop them going out? Not difficult at all. If it wasn't for this miracle, the Egyptians would have been able to physically restrain the Jews from leaving Egypt without a problem. In exactly the same way, it would have been possible to restrain Moshe from leaving this world if it wasn't that God applied that same miraculous gezeirah as He did in the other two cases. How? Imagine if we would know that secret. Imagine if we would know how to stop death. Because that's what we're talking about. At least delay death. Millions and millions and millions of rands are poured into medical research to extend the person's life a little bit, to extend a little bit more, a little bit more. Here we have. It can be done without those millions of rands. It can be done without medicine altogether. It is possible for one person to extend the life of another one. In exactly the same way as it's possible physically to hold him from going somewhere, so it's possibly possible to hold him from leaving this world. How do we do it? I have a medrash, but before I do the medrash, I'm going to do the piece of Tanakh on which the medrash is based. I think before I do that, I'm going to give you the answer. Because the answer is really in the Rashi. And again, these are things I would not say on my own. These are still all at its foundations in Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz. By the way, it gives you a little bit of an indication of who Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz was. I've been talking to you now for 6 weeks. I think this is the sixth shiur. All this comes from two shiurim of Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz. There's a little bit that I've added into it, but not very much. A little bit of flavoring, more than anything else. All of these 6 weeks come from two shiurim of Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz. That's how one needs to understand them. And they were written out. Each shiur covers two pages. So all in all, it's four pages of Reb Chaim that we've been busy on for 6 weeks. What do they say? What is the method they use? Actually, Rashi tells us the answer. If we notice that he's about to leave this world, we won't let him. Up till there, they're saying the same as the people in the generation of Noah said, and the same as the people as the Egyptians said. So up till there, there's nothing unique. But now starts a whole new story. Adam shoyt Zion mi Mitzrayim ve korol lanu es hayom ve hoyrid lanu es hamon ve higiz lanu es hatzlo ve helo lanu es habeir ve nosan lanu es hatzoro. The man who took us out of Egypt, split the sea, brought down the mon and the slav, brought up the water and gave us the Torah, we're not going to let him go. So Zubchan Shmulevitz, that's HaKoros HaTov. HaKoros HaTov, recognizing a debt of gratitude, can stop a person's death. That's all he says, he doesn't explain it. I'm going to explain it to you, the explanation is very simple, and then you'll see that explanation in the Medrash. The power, when we talk about the power of the human being, really what is required in anything he's doing, whether it's his physical strength that needs to be utilized to the full, or his intellectual strength, or his spiritual strength, the thing that is needed is total application. He's got to use everything he's got. If he's using 5% of his concentration, like most of us use, it's no wonder that his achievements have to be limited. If he uses 10% of his physical ability, which is probably more than most of us use, no wonder that physically he doesn't excel. And if he uses 1% of his spiritual capacity, which is a good deal more than any of us use, no wonder he doesn't excel spiritually. The one thing that is needed is total application. You've got to give everything you've got to really excel in any area, whatever. When we talk about giving everything we've got, we're talking about trying something, applying energy and effort almost to the point of death. That's really what we're, where you almost kill yourself over it, where you apply yourself so selflessly and with such extreme devotion that you aren't even noticing what kind of energy it's taking out of you. That's when people excel, and sometimes it even requires the giving of their life. When there have been great acts of heroism, it's been by people whose life has come second to what they're doing. And sometimes they've had to give their life, and sometimes they haven't. They've been able to survive, but still, at all times, their life came second. First came what they were doing. And one hears of the stories of heroism in the Six-Day War. It's probably the last war where one hears about such acts almost. A little bit in the Yom Kippur War as well, but not to the same extreme. These were acts of people just putting their life second. That's all. Life was second. When a man gets into a tractor to build a road up the Golan Heights, and he knows that he has no chance of doing more than 100 meters or so, if that, before he's going to be killed, no chance whatever, and then somebody else is going to have to take over from him, and he might make another 100 meters before he's killed, and so it's going to have to go, and it's just the last ones that are actually going to get to the top, and they're not only volunteers, but the problem is just to choose who goes first. Those are people whose lives go second. And those are people who can win such a war. Those are people who can build a road up a mountain when a much more powerful enemy is busy shooting down. How can you do such a thing? It's not normal. Of course it's not normal. It's Mesiras Nefesh. And Mesiras Nefesh, giving of one's life or being prepared to give of one's life, is that which enables one to excel beyond all expectations. Far beyond what one would think one is physically capable of. In fact, far beyond what one is physically capable of. Because it's a completely different dimension when you start with Mesiras Nefesh. What's the whole argument among the English themselves in the Falkland dispute? Mesiras Nefesh. That's all. British blood is spilling. Oy, oy, oy. You've got to decide before you go on in this kind of thing what comes first. Life? Or that for which we're fighting? And if you go into the fight believing that life comes first, don't have a chance of winning the fight, no matter how powerful you are. One needs Mesiras Nefesh for that. You need to know, if you're going to fight, you might die. And that's just too bad. The fight is more important than the life. And that's the way one has to get into a fight, into a war. That's the way one has to get into a battle of principle, even if it's not a war. And that's the way one has to get into one's day-to-day battles for life, battles for existence. If one's going to start putting life first, and financial interest first, and security first, and family first, and friends first, there are a whole lot of firsts that come before principles, then you have a world that starts rotting away. Only when you develop the type of individual where the principles come first and life comes second and everything else comes second, then one's talking about a person of moral caliber. Of course, there are laws as to when you may give your life and when you may not give your life. You can't just go and give your life for any little moral principle. So when we talk about Mesiras Nefesh, generally we're talking not about actually giving your life, but about a certain preparedness to apply everything you've got till the point of giving your life. Just till that point. And when required, even to give your life. HaKoros HaToiv to Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's just understand this Rashi here first. What are they saying? This is the man who took us out of Egypt. This is the man who split the sea. This is the man who gave us the mon, the slav, the water, and gave us the Torah. Without him, what would we be today? We would have been slaves in Egypt if we survived. And if we got out of Egypt, we would have died at the sea. And if we managed to get across the sea by some kind of Dunkirk miracle, we would have died of starvation. And if we didn't die of starvation for some other miracle, we would have died of thirst. And even if we managed to survive, what would we be after all that without the Torah? Absolutely nothing. So our life is worthless without a Moshe Rabbeinu. What's the question? Am I going to give my life for Moshe or not? He owns my life. He has a right on my life. And that puts them into a category of Mesiras Nefesh. They didn't know what it meant to hang on to Moshe, but they knew that it might mean their own death. That doesn't matter. When those people were mispalel, when they prayed with that kind of Mesiras Nefesh, when they prayed with that kind of attitude that we're praying for a man whom we cannot repay, we're praying for a man whose life is more important to us than our own life, because whatever life we've got comes from him. If that's the way you pray, God says that's as powerful as 500 men restraining Noah from walking into the ark. Under normal conditions, I couldn't overcome that prayer, says God. I couldn't turn a blind ear, a deaf ear, to that kind of prayer, says God. There's no way I would have to give in. It's only because Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, it's a gezeirah, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, I'm going to do it in broad daylight, and because this is an exceptional circumstance, your prayers aren't going to help. But under normal circumstances, your prayers would have helped, even to delay the death of Moshe, because they would have been prayers with Mesiras Nefesh. We find this several times. Another time that we find it is, in fact, in Gemara Sanhedrin. Tanu Rabbanan, we learnt, Kesheholo Rabbi Eliezer, when Rabbi Eliezer became ill, Nichnusu Arbo Zakenim Levakroi. Four of the wise people, four Talmidei Chachomim, went to visit him. Rabbi Tarfin, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elozer ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva. Are they familiar names to you? These are the same, they were obviously very close. These were the same people that were sitting in Bnei Brak having a Seder, you remember. It's Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Tarfin, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elozer ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva. Neme Rabbi Tarfin Volma. Rabbi Tarfin started off and he said to the sick Rabbi Eliezer, Tov ato li Yisrael mitipo shel geshomim. You are more valuable to the Jewish people than a drop of rain. Shetipo shel geshomim boilum hazeh verebi boilum hazeh boilum habo. Because a drop of rain only has value in this world, it only has physical value, whereas you have physical value and spiritual value to us. So you are more valuable to us than rain. Nene Rabbi Yeshua boma. So Rabbi Yeshua started speaking and said, Tov ato li Yisrael yose migalgal chamo. You are more valuable to Israel than the sun. Because the sun is only in this world and you are in the world to come as well. You are better even than a mother and father, because a mother and father is only in this world and you are for the world to come as well. What's going on? What are the three things here? So the pashtus, there are many things one can say on this Gemara, but in simple terms, Rabbi Tarfon started off and he said, you like rain. That means that we as seeds, Klal Yisrael as seeds, whatever we're able to achieve through our own growth, we couldn't achieve without the environment, without the water. So you're feeding us all the time. At the end, what we are is thanks to you. The next one comes, Rabbi Yeshua comes and he says much more than that. He says, you like the sun. Not only does the sun give to the plant, actually give physically to the plant, but also the sun is that towards which the plant grows. The sun guides the plant. So the plant actually moves towards the sunlight. So it's not just like the water that goes into the earth and pushes the plant out, so to say, gives the plant strength to grow, but you're more like the sun. You push us out in one way, you give us strength, and in the other way, you're that towards which we're growing. You're defining the guidelines. You are there for us to emulate. And therefore you're more important not only than rain, you're more important even than the sun. It's a step higher. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says you're more important even than a mother and a father. Because a mother and a father has that. It's like the water. The mother and the father are responsible for the creation of the child. The mother and the father are responsible for that towards which the child aspires. And the mother and father are also responsible for the nurturing of the child during the period of growth. It's an additional factor. The water doesn't have to nurture the plant, it just feeds the plant. The sun must just be there for the plant to grow towards. But parents have to be there day and night, nurturing and nurturing and looking after the nonsense. In fact, the Gemara says that's exactly how a Talmid Chacham has to be in Klal Yisrael, like a mother is to children. He's going to nurse them and nurse them and nurse them. And says to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, you're better than a mother and father, because a mother and father is only in Olam Hazeh, and you're also in spiritual matters, you're for the world to come. Why exactly at this time, Master Chaim Shmulevitz? His whole lifetime he's left. Obviously, they didn't tell him all these nice things. And now his life is over and he's about to die, and they come and tell him how wonderful he is and how he's needed and how tremendous he is, and each one adding on to what the one before said. So Zub Chaim Shmulevitz, this is the same gedder as the Rashi we've just had. This is before they stand to start being mispalo for him as a dying man. They're going to pray for him. Before they mispalo for him, they're talking to themselves, they're not talking to him. It's not important for him to know that. He's dying. It's important for them to know to what extent they need him. To what extent Klal Yisrael needs him. It's like watching rain disappear. Imagine you knew that this is the last rain, there's never going to be rain again. You can't do it, it just can't be. One has to be Mesa Nefesh. Everything one has into whatever tefillah is, there can't be such a thing, no more rain. Imagine we watch the sun get smaller and smaller and smaller and it's about to disappear. And we sit there drinking tea. You can't do it, you can't live without the sun. A mother and father, particularly at the stage when an infant needs the mother and father, you can't just say, oh shame, they're dying. Can't do it. Everything that one has in all one's life has to go into keeping them. And that they've got to realize before they start being mispado for Rabbi Eliezer. They've got to realize that everything they've got, every bit of their koach has to go into this prayer, because they cannot survive, Klal Yisrael cannot survive without a Rabbi Eliezer. That's what they need to realize. And it's feasible to save him with a tefillah if it would be done properly. Before I do the Medrash with you, which will actually enunciate this statement, I'll put the question again, which is you'll now see even more vividly, and that is, how can one have such a feeling of Mesilas Nefesh? If the principle is that one must have Mesilas Nefesh, one must feel. Well, let's look at the Medrash. It's in fact the Medrash I started with you last week. We're going to just finish the Medrash now. When God said to Moshe, I'm going to now send you to Paro, what did Moshe say last week, you'll remember? He said, sorry, Ribbono Shel Olam, can't go. I've got something else to do first. Because Yisroi accepted me and opened his home to me. And as such, I am like a child in his home. And if a man opens his home, opens his heart to another human being, that man is chayev his life to him. He owes his life to that man. It's a statement of the Medrash. What was the saying? Atirin, how was it? Atirfa, you see, it's a Medrash. It's the a man opens his home to you, opens his heart to you, enables you to walk in and out freely. You're chayiv your nefesh, you owe your life to him. And the same we find happened by Tzolfis, by Eliyahu, when he went to Tzolfis the widow and her son died. So that's a little piece of Tanakh that I want to do. But the question is now, if that's the case, that to somebody who's opened his house to you, you owe your life. No, I understand. Moshe came out of Egypt with nothing. He was fleeing. Paro was out to kill him. Yitro opened his house to him. Eliyahu was dying of starvation. Tzolfis Ha'amona opens her house to him. I understand the feeling of I owe my life to such a person. If it weren't for them, I would be dead. But how does one do that in the Talmid Rav situation? Without him, I would be dead. I wouldn't be dead. I would be living very nicely. And many people have been telling me I'd be living a good deal happier without you. So what kind of thing? How is it possible to even have such a kind of feeling and such a kind of relationship? And even if you wouldn't be living exactly the same, so you would have learned from somebody else. It's not the same kind of thing where without this person I would be dead. And yet the Shulchan Aruch says that here the degree of Hakadosh Baruch Hu has to be still greater. How does one feel that feeling of Mesiras Nefesh to somebody who, for whom one's life is not really totally in bond? A fascinating piece of Tanakh where Eliyahu was wandering around in a state of extreme poverty, and God tells him to go to this place, and there he's arranged for a certain widow to supply him with some fruit, food. Go to Tzofos HaShel Tzidon V'yoshav Toshon and dwell there. Hinei Tzivisi Shom Ishu Amon Elechal Kelecho. I have commanded, this is in chapter 11 of Melachim Aleph, I have commanded a woman there, a widow, to look after you. Vayakom vayelech Tzofos, and he went there to Tzofat, and he came to the entrance of the city. Vihinei shom isho almono mekosheshes etzim, and there was a widowed woman chopping trees. How did he know he was widowed? She was widowed. Maybe otherwise the husband would have been chopping the trees, or he saw the anguish and the sadness of her situation on her face. Vayikra Eliyahu, and he called to her, Vayomar, and he said, Kichino li miat mayim bakli ve'eshte, said Eliyahu to this old lady, please give me a little bit of water and let me drink. Vatelech lakacha, she went to bring. Vayikra Eliyahu, and she said, Vayomar, Kichino li pas lechem biyodech, can you give me a little piece of bread to eat? Vatomer, so she said, Chai Hashem Elokecha, by the life of the Lord your God, imyeshli moeg, if I've got anything, ki meloichaf kemach bakad, I've got one spoon of flour in the container, umiat shemen betzapochas, and a little bit of oil in the bottle. Vinani mekoshesh shnai meitzim, and I plan to chop two pieces of wood. Uvotzi vosisihu li velivni, and I plan to come and make this the fire for myself and my son. Vachalunu, and we're going to eat this last bit of oil and water. This last, we'll bake a little piece of bread. Vomasnu, and then we're going to die. It's the end of our lives. There's nothing else we can do. So you're still asking me for bread? Sorry, I don't have. Vayomer Eliyahu Eliyahu, so Eliyahu said to her, Al tiri, don't worry, boi asichi dvorech, do as you said, achasi li mishom uge ktano barishoine, but first make a little piece of bread for me. Vohitzesli, and bring it to me, v'loch v'livnech tasi b'achroin, and when you've made for me, make some for your children as well. But she just told him she's got nothing. Ki choy ama Hashem Elokei Yisrael, because so said God, kada kemach lo yisichla, the container of flour will not be completed. And the container of oil will not run down. Ad yom titein Hashem geshim al pnei ha'adam, until the day where Hashem will bring rain onto the ground, and again there will be plenty to eat. Batelech batase kidvar Eliyahu, and she did as Eliyahu told her. Do you know what emuna and bitochen that is? To take her last piece of bread. If it was just her, she might have been able to do it. Still, a poor man comes. One does heroic things under those circumstances, but the child, she's got a baby who's dying of hunger, this is his last meal, after this he dies, and she's got enough for one piece of bread, a little challah, small challah, and she's going to make a small challah and give it to Eliyahu, because Eliyahu told her, don't worry God, there's more where it came from. And she ate, he, behu, veso, yomim, and they ate for a long time. The flour didn't finish, and the oil didn't run out. And it was after that, says the Tanakh, the Balabostu's son became ill, and he became very ill until he could no longer breathe. And she said to Eliyahu, what have you got to do with me, O man of God? What are you doing here? Boso Elayla asks you, Savoini Lohomis is believe, you come here to remind God of my sins so that my son should die. Bayomir Eletz Nilich is Benech, he said to her, give me your son, your sick son. Bayikocheu Mecheko, and he took the son out of her bosom. Bayaleu Elho Aliyo Asheru Yoshev Shom, and he took him up to the attic where Leo had his room where he was staying. Bayashkiveu Almitoso, and he laid the child out on the bed. Vayikro el Hashem vayomer, and he called out to God and he said, Hashem Elokayo, Lord my God, Agam alo almono asher ani misgoyer erimo hereyoso lohomis es beno. this lady who's doing chesed to me, in whose house I'm staying, are you going to kill her son? Says the Medrash. You find the same principle with Eliyahu, the principle of somebody who opens their house to you, you owe your life to them. When he went to Tzofis, the Amona, her son died. The pasuk we've just read, are you going to kill the son of the woman who's done chesed to me, who's opened her house to me? And it says further on, Vayishma Hashem b'kol Eliyahu v'atashiv nefesh hayilid. And Hashem listened to the voice of Eliyahu, and the spirit of the child returned. In other words, the child was dead. Not only the situation of where do we have where the people are trying to keep Moshe from dying, but here we have a situation where the child is dead and is revived without artificial resuscitation. It's not like the other story with Elisha. This is without touching him physically. Only by prayer he was able to actually revive a dead person. How? Because of the principle shekol ha'pesach pitche lechaveru chayiv benafshe. It says the Medrash further that you chayiv even more than to a parent, to somebody who opens the house to you. But before we do that, very strange, what did she lose, this woman? How much did Eliyahu really owe her? What did she give him? All she had when he came was a little bit of flour and a little bit of oil. And at this stage they've been living on years, but it's thanks to who? To Eliyahu. So where's that cause? That so who owes who the favor? Nevertheless, makes no difference. It was only through Eliyahu that she was able to receive the blessing from God. That's true. Or shall we say it's the other way around? Eliyahu ate from God, he didn't eat from the lady. When he came, she didn't have enough for her and her son. There was no way he could get food from her. So where did his food come from? This food that Eliyahu has been eating all these weeks and months, where did it come from? A miracle from the Ribbono Shel Olam. So be grateful to God. Why do you have to be grateful to the Almona? It doesn't matter. The Almona was the Shadchonis. The Almona made it possible for Eliyahu to receive the food from God. There has to be, God doesn't just dish out food. There has to be something with which it all starts. And she had that something. And here we've got an exact parallel situation in a physical sense to the situation of the Talmid-Rav relationship. Eliyahu receives directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam. All he needs the Almona for is to make the connection. And for that he owes his life to her. And he prays for her with Mesiras Nefesh. Says the Medrash, even more so than for a parent. Because if they had this power, if Eliyahu had this power, and we know that Elisha had this power of reviving the dead, ask the Medrash, why didn't they go and revive their parents? Imagine such a power. They should have gone to the cemetery and revived all their parents and ancestors and everybody. Wouldn't have worked. They wouldn't have had that same degree. That's something we don't have to have the chance now to go into exactly why that is so. Why here? Even in this case, there's more gratitude owing to the old lady than there would be to their own parents. Probably because the parents still have some degree of an obligation. It's true. Parents have done an awful lot, and we've seen how extreme are the requirements of kibbutz. But Mesiras Nefesh, to this degree, there isn't really, because the parents were obligated to a degree. Whereas in the case of the Almona, she wasn't obligated. To give her last piece of bread, that means she's sacrificing her life and her child's life, trusting that Eliyahu is going to save her after all. That she didn't have to do, that was Mesiras Nefesh from her side. She was Mesiras Nefesh for the child. You remember the Gemara we had in the Dorim last week, that Moshe didn't have to teach the Torah to the Jewish people either. There were parts of it that he had to hand over. But to teach the art of learning Torah, he didn't have to do that. He could have just given them the facts. That was Tovas Ayin Shel Moshe Rabbeinu. It was Moshe's generosity. And here we come to this extra dimension, the dimension of tonight, of that which obligates still more Mesiras Nefesh and still more Hakoras HaTov. That the element of the person to whom one is indebted, not having been obligated in the first place to create that indebtedness. A parent, it's natural, a parent does it. But Moshe didn't have to give us the Torah in the way that patient. And nevertheless he does. That's what introduces that extra element of Hakoras HaTov, which puts it into the same category of Eliyahu to the old lady, to the Almona. That category of Hakoras HaTov, which is owed to somebody who wasn't obligated to give you what he gave you. If only one would appreciate these principles, You can't imagine what a pleasant place the world would be. Just imagine for a moment, firstly, that one understood the principles. The principles basically are that there has to be developed inside an individual an intolerance of indebtedness. One has to try continuously to pay off debts. If one developed that, as well as the ability to notice an indebtedness, which is also part of the problem, imagine if everybody would be going around trying to pay their debts. There wouldn't be inflation in an economic sense, and there wouldn't be inflation in a moral sense. Inflation in an economic sense is people trying to borrow money without repaying. And the moral climate in which we live is exactly the same. Everybody trying to take, everybody trying to look after themselves, everybody worried about themselves trying to take without repaying. And rationalizing why they don't really owe, and why it's quite okay to owe. And it's a vicious circle, exactly the same as an economy. It pays to borrow, because with inflation as it is, what you'll be paying back in 5 years' time is really hardly worth anything at all, so you might as well borrow. That's really theft. Because from who are you taking it? If that's true, that I must borrow today, because when I pay it back, it's not going to be worth anything. So what am I doing? I'm simply stealing from the person who lent me the money. The fact that he agreed to lend me the money nevertheless, so that means I'm not stealing. That means I owe an awful lot of korus atoiv. That means he's dishing out. He's giving me charity. He's allowing me to pay him back in a much smaller currency in 5 years' time than it's worth now. One needs our korus atoiv for that as well. That's in the economic sense. In the moral sense, it's exactly the same. People rationalize why they're entitled to take for themselves and take and take and take. And all they're worried about is where will they do best and where will they grow best and where will they achieve best. And that's the end of the story. And they justify it and moralize it. And the real principles are left completely neglected. And the principle of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just gone. Imagine if that weren't the situation. Imagine if we went around trying to pay debts as far as we could, as much as we could, recognizing debts. Imagine further, if there was such an environment, how much more pleasant it would be to do people favors. Now, part of the difficulty in doing people favors is that you just feel sometimes it's like dropping a stone into a bottomless pit, and you wait for that little clink at the bottom, you don't hear anything. So you drop a bigger stone, you listen, you wait, you don't hear anything. So eventually you give up. That satisfaction of hearing a drop at the bottom and getting the echo back, that's all that the Baal Chesed wants to feel sometimes. And in fact, it is said by the Balei Musa and in Halacha that you're not obligated to do a kindness to a person who doesn't appreciate it. Chesed does not have to be done to somebody who doesn't have HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because part of the whole purpose of Chesed is to be Marbe Shalom, is to increase peace among people. How are you increasing peace if the guy doesn't even notice what you've done? So you're simply not obligated to do anything for a man who doesn't show that appreciation. Certainly, can you imagine if people did show the appreciation and they did show the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how much more eager everybody would be to go around doing Chesed? What a pleasure it would be to hear that beautiful sound of the stone clink at the bottom of the well. And it would give such nachas and such sipuk that everybody would go around looking for opportunities to do kindness in order to get that fulfillment. Because there's nothing greater in terms of fulfillment than hearing that little clink. So now you've thrown it away, you're never going to see it again. But down at the bottom there, you heard it land. It's been received. You know that it's there. And that's a kind of feeling which people would pursue, they would chase after. We're living in an age where people want meaningful things. They want to do things that are meaningful. They want to do things that are deep and that are human. It's just it doesn't help doing them today because the other person isn't human. So you do it and you don't hear the kink. Eventually you give up. But if there was that kind of atmosphere of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the whole thing, the whole game would be different. People would be running around doing Chesed and responding to Chesed. And it would just never end. A does to B and B responds to A. Now A feels that what's the point? If he's already been paid back, he owes another one. So he does again and B does back. And C benefits, so C does back to A and B, and A and B does to C and D, and so it goes. It becomes infectious. And likewise, the inflation becomes infectious too when it's taking without the giving back. In terms of a Talmid Rav relationship, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu is much more difficult, as I mentioned briefly last week, and I'll just finish off with that this week. And that is that to pay for something physically and physical and measurable, one can pay. To pay for life, one can't. So one already sees that Eliyahu was Moser Nefesh for this Almona, for this old lady. We see that there are times when Moshe Rabbeinu, even if Klal Yisrael have to wait as far as getting out of Egypt is concerned, that's none of his business. He's got to go and say goodbye to Yitro first. So there's some things one would have to pay with one's life. Since it's not feasible, one tries as far as one can with Mesiris Nefesh at least. There are some things that one can pay. Simply, there's a debt, has a measure to it. It was 100 rand that you borrowed and inflation's been running at 18%, so 5 years later you can calculate what that is and you can repay. What a Rav gives the Talmud cannot be repaid. But particularly in the one area, and that is not just in the area of teaching him Aleph Beis, although even that is considered teaching and it's considered already an unrepayable debt. But more particularly in the unique style that the particular Rav has, which he should have. Eliyahu couldn't have gone to any old lady and asked for some flour and done the same trick. There was only one old lady who God had set aside who was capable of making that shidduch. And for each Talmud, dependent on his attitude, dependent on his mind, dependent on his neshama, on his soul, on his personality, there's basically one or two derochim, one or two attitudes at different stages of his life or at any stage of his life, where he will be suited and where he will be able to make that connection of Kabbalah Satorah that we've been discussing. I brought you the Gemara where one of the Tanoim said that he's never said anything that he didn't hear from his Rebbe. And Reb Chaim asks on that too and says, but this is one of the most creative Tanoim that we had, that the Mishnah itself says about him, that he said things which had never been heard before. So creative was his learning. And he's the one who says, I've never said anything that my Rebbe didn't tell me. Therefore, says Reb Chaim, it doesn't mean that he was a copycat. It doesn't mean that he just, whatever his Rebbe said, that's what he said. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for creative talents in learning, not just for copying. But he made sure that whatever he said was along the style and had the stamp of the personality of his Rebbe in it. The kind of thing his Rebbe would have been proud of saying, even if he didn't actually say it himself. That was his test. And says Reb Chaim, that's the gedder of Akoros HaTov in the Talmud-Rav relationship. When a Talmud is able to pinpoint the uniqueness of the particular Rav under which he's learning. This is not just Talmud-Rav relationship, but this moves into other relationships too. I heard from Reb Chaim, although it's not printed, that the same applies in the parental relationship. That there too, a child has to specifically see what is unique about his parents. He has to work on finding out what it is that he got from his parents apart from mere life, that he couldn't have got from anybody else, that only they could have given him. Because each person has uniqueness, and each Talmid Chacham has uniqueness, and each teacher has uniqueness, and one can learn something from a particular teacher which you cannot possibly learn from another teacher. Each one according to his own style and his own approach and his own derech. But it's necessary to be able to pinpoint that, it's necessary to be able to notice that and to respond to that uniqueness. That's the little click at the bottom of the pit that the Rav listens for. Has he just learnt the Aleph Beis? Or does he understand what I'm getting at, as opposed to what everybody else is getting at? Does he understand the finesse of what I'm trying to develop? And when he does, that's the kink. That's the Akoros HaTov. That means I understand the uniqueness of you in my life. And then he's got the kink, then he understands it. There are many different derochim in Torah, there are many different derochim in Yiddishkeit, and each individual finds at different stages in his life the particular derech and the particular approach that suits him. I've often said, and unfortunately needs to be reminded, and one needs to remember that the derech and the approach in this Beis HaMedrash is Shnayim Shehem Echad, it's two which is really one. In the learning sense, whether it's men learning or women learning or men and women learning or children learning, makes no difference. In the learning sense, it's not sacrificing MSKIT for anything. Not sacrificing truth for anything. Not for covering ground, not for satisfaction, not for images, and not for some kind of fulfillment of having done something when one hasn't really done it properly. That's the learning. But it has to be, one has to know what one has learnt, understanding it, or leave it with a question that one has defined. I don't understand this because A, B, C. And then one can carry on. But not leaving anything vague and not leaving anything superficial, even worse than vague. Because vague, you go away and you know that it's vague in your mind, so you don't trust yourself with it. Superficial, you think it's clear. And you think you know and you think you understand. And that's one thing which the space of Medrash stands for not doing. That is, whatever we do, whether it's learning a Medrash or a little piece of Tanakh or a Gemara in Sanhedrin, it needs to be understood, the yesod needs to be understood, the principle underlying it needs to be understood, and every word of it needs to be understood, or at least questioned intelligently and clearly. I've mentioned also that I'm less interested in how much you remember. I remember once, in fact, somebody came to see my father with Khalisha Sadas. He was depressed and he was about to give up his whole trip into Yiddishkeit. He said, "You know, I've been sitting and listening to your droshes for 8 years and I can't repeat one of them. If you ask me what Rabbi Lapin has said, I couldn't tell you. I don't know. Tell me to repeat one shiur of Rabbi Lapin's and I couldn't." This man was a doctor and a very outstanding doctor. And my father said to him, "Who was your professor of medicine?" And he told him. He said, "Tell me some of the things he said." "Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember that either." "And yet you're a good doctor. Where does your medicine come from?" "Your medicine comes from what he taught you. You remember every principle he taught you. You don't need to remember the words anymore. What you remember is the yesod. And that even if you can't verbalize it, you're living it, never mind remembering it." I'm really not that interested in how much people remember. That's your own business. If you want to remember, then you must revise. If you want to remember better, you must revise again. That's your business to decide whether you want to remember something or you don't. The main thing is that you have access to it, that you know how to find it, that you know how to look for it, and more important than that, that you understood it at the time with depth and clarity. Because if you understood the principle with depth and clarity, believe me, you will never ever forget it. Deep down in your mind, it's there. The mind grabs onto things that are deep and to things that are true. It doesn't let it out that easily. And even if you can't recall it, you haven't forgotten it. Whereas when one is doing things superficially, it's at the front of one's mind, and when it's no longer at the front of one's mind, it's gone. And the second area, which is part of the first, is the Musa. As I mentioned to the ladies this morning, that the Torah is a means to becoming a mensch. And the standards of menschlichkeit are high. The standards of menschlichkeit are the type of standards we've been talking about, where you do give your life for a principle, where you do lose out for a principle, where you do sometimes have to take sides and commit yourself, even if it's going to cost you a job, or even if it's going to cost you the loss of a friend, or whatever it is. There are times when one has to commit oneself, and one can't just sit on the fence indeterminately, continuously, just trying to sit around and sit around. There are things that are right and there are things that are wrong. There is a grey area. There's very often a big grey area, and it requires a great degree of maturity to handle the grey areas effectively. But the whole of life is not a grey area. Every human being doesn't fit into the grey area. There are tzaddikim and there are rishoyim, there are talmidei chachamim and there are amaratzim. There is truth and there is falsehood. There is right and there is wrong. There is chiyuv and there is isur. There is obligation and there is prohibition. And according to the Chovas Halvavos, in the area of chiyuv and isur, of obligation and prohibition, there is no grey area. A thing is either constructive or it's destructive. And one needs clarity of mind to be able to determine which is which. And having determined, one needs moral character and strength of character to be able to stick to that which one has decided is right, no matter what the cost is. And those are the two things, the learning and the musa. The learning which enables you to look at the world in a way where you're able to distinguish, to be mavdil ben kodesh l'chol, to distinguish between that which is holy and that which is secular. And it's very fooling sometimes. If it would be so easy that what looks secular is secular and what looks holy is holy, it wouldn't be a big kunst to be a tzaddik, I assure you. The problem is that very often what looks holy is secular, and what looks secular can be holy. And what looks right is sometimes wrong, and what looks wrong is sometimes right, and it's only through the Torah and through halacha that one can really figure out what is right and what is wrong, what is true and what is false. And the second is the Musa. Now, knowing that which is true and that which is false, as the Vilna Gaon said at the Shalashuddas a few weeks ago, now knowing what is true and what is false, one needs to be able to live that way. One needs the strength of character to follow it through, no matter what. And those are the two foundations of this Beis HaMedrash. That's what it stands for. Within the learning, it's a rich area. Within the Musa, it's a rich area. There are different shittas, and there are different derochim and different methods. It doesn't matter. As long as they are all unsacrificing and uncompromising on emeskite. That's the one common denominator that has to be in any approach. Any group of young people sitting around the table and learning, each one will have a slightly different approach. Each one will find a different meaning and a different understanding in words. And that's part of the richness of learning together in a group. And it's meant to be that way. But there has to be a certain common framework. And the common framework is that the emeskite, the truth, is not compromised no matter what. Rather, I don't know than I think. And the second, in the Musa too, there are different ways of Musa, different shittas of Musa, different styles of Musa, different ways of living and doing things. But there has to be one common denominator, and that is self-interest doesn't come before what is right. And that when one is clarified and one knows what is right, one develops the self-discipline, the guts and the strength of character in a world which doesn't really admire that kind of thing anymore, to stand up for it and to do it, no matter what it costs. That really ends the series that we've discussed. Next week we'll, Mir Sashem, go into other equally interesting topics.